Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Time to take a look at the wonderful world of wildlife here in Wisconsin, in our state. And well, there's some things that aren't so wonderful. One is deer vehicle accidents, and we'll talk about that with Scott Craven back with us. Meredith, UW Extension wildlife ecologist, comes by every couple months to talk about the great outdoors. And he has some defensive driver tips maybe that would help you out in a potential collision. We'll talk about the gun deer season, the grouse populations, how to protect your house and garden from mice and other invaders to your house. And you can join in with your own questions and maybe your own outdoor experiences. Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234. We always like to see outdoor photos too. If you got an outdoor photo and maybe a question associated with it, or just because you want to send us one, do that too. You can email those to ideas@wpr.org. And certainly you can post your question there without a photo. Can't they, Scott?
They can.
They can. Scott says it's okay. So.
Yeah, it's fine with me.
You know, I drove my daughter to school this morning. I drive from sort of a special deal. I don't always do this, but I did it this morning. Drove from Madison to Lake Mills, which is about 20 miles. And then I drove back to Madison. So on the way to Lake Mills, there were two dead deer along the road. And on the way back, on the other side, going the other way, there were three. So that's five deer in kind of, I guess you could say, a 40-mile stretch. But if you multiply that out,
it adds up to a big number.
It's up to a very big number, as I'm sure the insurance companies will tell us.
Well, it's that time of year. The rut or breeding season started not too many days ago. And, of course, the archery hunters who are out keep close tabs on when the rut, what phases of the rut, and it becomes a bit of a science trying to figure out what the deer are up to. But the bottom line for the average person or non-deer hunter is this is a time of the year, and it'll probably last for another at least a week, right up until the gun deer season starts, and then there's another reason to be careful.
Mm-hmm.
Bottom line is, for the next few weeks, people who are out driving, especially at dusk or dawn, but during the rut, could be any time of day, including high noon. The bucks are running willy-nilly around the landscape looking for receptive does. It's that time of year, and that is really the only thing the bucks seem to be thinking about. You hear stories about archery hunters seeing one coming through the woods with its nose to the ground following a doe, and they're completely oblivious, seemingly oblivious to everything else. It's not quite that much of a slam dunk when you're hunting, but this is a time of year when people want to be in the woods. As far as being on the road is concerned, keep your eyes open and glance at the shoulders and ditches and watch those deer crossing signs. They're there for a reason. But, again, much like any time of day, a buck can appear running across the road virtually anywhere.
Yeah.
And you need to be prepared to apply the brakes. If you can't avoid the deer, the general rule of thumb is much better. It may not seem like it, but better to kind of drive through it, try and stay on the road, and you hit the deer, well, so be it, than to swerve and put yourself at risk of a head-on collision in the other lane, or swerve off the road and connect with a utility pole or a tree. All of those examples worse than hitting the deer. But it is a big problem. Thousands of collisions a year in Wisconsin, as you just indicated with the Lake Mills story, and usually a few human fatalities.
Yeah.
Often involving motorcyclists.
Yeah.
You need to be especially cautious this time of year.
Yeah.
And obviously thousands of deer, dead or mortally injured, to crawl off the road. It's an unfortunate thing, but it's part of life in Wisconsin.
I was trying to think of, I know most of my friends at one point or another, at the least, have had a very close encounter and, maybe just a near miss. I've never hit a deer myself, but I've been in the car with, somebody else driving, and we hit one. So.
A few years ago, I think I may have taken the first deer of the, whatever it was, 2012 season, because we were on our way to the farm in Iowa County to hunt, pitch
and
black,
one.
5 o'clock in the morning, wham! And
there you go.
Yeah, $2,400 later. Well, anyway,
there.
Be careful, folks. There's a lot of deer out there, and you don't want to hit one.
Why? Well, let's go to Daniel in Madison. Daniel, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hello.
What's on your mind?
I want to know why we don't do anything to prevent deer collisions. Like other states I travel, they always have corrals or lights out or motion detectors. Or even if deer, is it true that deer won't cross over like where humans go to the bathroom, you know, pee in? So why can't we spray it alongside the highway and maybe prevent them from crossing?
Well, interesting idea, Daniel. But there have been a few things around the country tested that worked. Some states and Canadian provinces are building big wildlife overpasses to get large game animals across major highways. Wisconsin has always used roadside fencing as a bit of a tactic, and I'm sure that diverts some deer, not all of them. Even seemingly very high fences around airports and high security areas occasionally get breached by deer. So while it would seem, hey, let's keep them off the road, it's not a completely viable alternative. And scents and the flashing lights, while there may be some warning motion sensors, the problem is, in my opinion, less with the deer and more with the motorists who tend to disregard things they see constantly, like a deer crossing sign. Some people still think the deer crossing sign's up there, not for the motorist, but for the deer to see. It's, hey, this is a good place to cross the road. So I mean, people need to assume some responsibility to pay some attention to high-risk areas, high-risk times of day, high-risk times of year, like now, and be observant. And I don't believe there's any substitute for really astute defensive driving at this time of year.
Yeah, absolutely. There you go, Daniel. Thanks for calling. Ann in Madison, your turn. Hi, Ann.
Hi, I have a bird question. I'm hoping Scott can answer. I recently discovered a nest in one of my bushes. I don't know what kind of a bird it's from. I'm wondering whether birds are likely to reuse the nest, like when they start nesting next year, or will it just be abandoned?
It depends a lot on
the
what
bird.
Kind of a bird it is. And not only that, it depends on whether the bird that built the nest, even if its intentions are, hey, I'm going back to Ann's yard and refurbish the home and raise another brood, there's no guarantee that with the mortality rates these birds suffer, that bird is ever going to make it back, regardless of whether it might use it again. It could be used by something else. It might be domed over this winter by a white-footed mouse and make a nice little nest in your bush for its existence. If it's not, why do you want to remove it, Ann? Or are you just curious about what its fate might be?
I'm wondering whether it's okay to destroy it or...
What does it look like?
Well, a bunch of very small twigs, and it used some parts of plastic bag or something it picked up somewhere. It's about 4 or 5 inches in diameter, outer diameter.
And it's in a bush?
It's in a hydrangea that I was trimming.
Hmm. Well, it could be any number of things, Ann, but I guess in a setting like that, I see no harm in just leaving it there to either deteriorate from the wind and weather over the winter or possibly be there for something to use it next spring. And once the hydrangea leafs out again and has big blooms on it, you'll never know whether it's there in the first place, which is probably why the bird selected it. So I thought where you were headed with this was that there was a nest on your porch light or a window box or some place where the nest was problematic last year, in that case, then my recommendation is, okay, as part of your fall cleanup, clean the nest off the light or off the place where it was causing problems getting into the house or whatever else, and then take some steps with a little bit of bird netting or some type of a wire covering or some other means that come next spring, the same bird or other birds like house finches that are prone to do that or robins will not be able to nest in that problematic spot. But as far as a nest in the hydrangea, hey, I just leave it and see what happens.
Yeah, there you go, Ann. Thank you for calling. Let's turn to Adam in Milwaukee. Hi, Adam.
Hello, hello. Thank you for taking my call. How you all doing this fine day?
Just great.
Pretty good.
What's on your mind today?
I have a question because I drive from Milwaukee to Madison with my job every day. And like you mentioned, I've seen lots and lots of dead deer. And I was kind of wondering why they don't get picked up or disposed of properly.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a pretty easy answer to that, Adam, and that is money. It's expensive. With thousands of dead deer out there on the road, they used to be picked up. They were often spray painted so that somebody knew they'd been reported, and then they got picked up and taken to the dump or whatever. It seems like that. I think it varies a little bit county to county, depending on their budget or inclination. But even so, at least in my travels around, I don't see the carcasses disappearing very often. And
no.
if you drive north on 39 all the way up into the Lakeland area, regularly go to our cabin, you see the same carcass over and over again and kind of measure its decomposition on the side of the road. I think people have become desensitized to that, but nevertheless, from my standpoint, I'd still like to see them, if not removed, at least in rural areas. How much effort is it to drag it into the ditch or push it into the ditch or whatever else where it will decompose or be taken by scavengers with no risk to the scavenger? If you leave the thing right on the white line on the side of the road and eagles or something else are feeding on it, all of a sudden there's a risk they'll become roadkill too. So I don't know what the politics of this situation are or the cost, but it seems to me that as a citizen, a highway crew driving by, they're already out there. They're already doing something. How long does it take to jump out, put the yellow lights on, jump out of the truck, push the thing in the ditch? That's just one person's humble opinion.
And there's been more than one eagle hit by cars because they were feeding on a deer carcass right next to the road. So,
there you go. I mean, Adam, there are lots of good reasons why they could be or should be moved or picked up, but I think basically it's a time, workload, money situation.
Yeah.
And for someone who's uptight about it, contact your county officials and find out what the real yeah. reason is and what it would take to do something about it.
Yeah, and at least encourage them to pull those deer off the side of the road. Thanks, Adam. Chris in Iron River, thank you for calling.
Good morning, Larry. I'm proof there's lots of deer in northern Wisconsin. I've hit 20 deer, one bear, and one Rottweiler.
Oh, jeez. 20 deer vehicle collisions?
Oh, yeah.
Do you have any insurance left, Chris?
Yeah, really good insurance.
Well,
the deer hit you half the time. You got to count those.
Yeah.
I'm just hoping I still have the Wisconsin record, that's all.
That's pretty impressive,
20
actually.
20 deer and one bear.
I've run into people who have hit, 6, 7, 8, 9, but boy, 20. That's impressive. I've only hit one deer and one bear. The bear was in Canada, but nevertheless, I hope I never come close to 20. and you say you've been hit a couple times.
Oh, God, yeah. They run right into you, come out of nowhere, and whack you in the side, take off mirrors and all kinds of fun stuff.
So that's another problem that we didn't talk about first is that you can be doing your best job of defensive driving and all of a sudden, the deer essentially hits you. And I remember my mentor at the university here talking about driving in Columbia County, driving along the road, and he saw a buck coming across an open farm field. And, you know, he did a quick calculation. Oh, my gosh, we're on a collision course here. So he started to slow down and try and judge either going ahead of the deer or behind it, and they kept getting closer and closer, and he's kind of jockeying with the car, and wham, the thing jumped over the fence and plowed right into the fender of his car. You know, sometimes there's little you can do.
You can't win for losing.
Wow, Chris's record is pretty impressive.
And thanks for reporting on that. If anybody else can beat 20 deer and one bear, I want to hear about it for sure.
Okay.
Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Scott Craven, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller. Dave Potratz, our engineer. Jill Nadeau, our producer. On the Ideas Network. Looking at the world of wildlife with Scott Craven, I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining in today. You can email us your photos or questions at ideas@wpr.org. Our lines are all filled, but the number is 800-642-1234. Andrew in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, Larry. How you doing?
Great. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
You guys were talking about bald eagles on the side of the road, and 2 years ago, I came real close to hitting one with my wife. We were heading up to my cabin up near Hayward, Wisconsin, and driving down a 55-mile-per-hour Highway 13 up there. We were 55 miles per hour, and I had to come to nearly a dead stop because feasting on a deer carcass right on the side of the road like you guys are talking about, and flew right over the windshield, and we could see the whole wingspan and everything, and they are some big birds. Oh, my God.
Yes, they are.
Especially when you see them up close like that. And their wings are spread.
Well, thanks for validating our concern over eagles on the roadside. So hopefully no one's going to call and say, yes, I did hit an eagle or
no.
Something else.
Thanks, Andrew. Those are the experiences you never forget, for sure. Well, Colleen in Presque Isle. Hi.
Hello. This is in regard to deer kill. My son lives in the Twin Cities area, and he is on a list of being called when a deer is killed on the side of the road. So oftentimes he will get a message in the middle of the night, but he will go out and bring the deer home, and he can butcher it for his freezer.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that happens in Wisconsin.
Well, it used to. You used to be able to get on a county-by-county list with the conservation officers so that when they got a roadkill deer that was reported that was fresh or potentially usable, that you'd work your way up the call, and conservation groups that needed a deer for a game dinner or just an individual who wanted one and maybe didn't hunt could end up getting the deer and putting it to use as opposed to it just decomposing on the roadside. That used to be pretty commonplace, and I don't know, I honestly don't know whether it's done anymore or not, Larry. I mean, most of them seem to sit there.
Yeah, I honestly don't know either. I really haven't heard that discussed in a long, long time.
Well, maybe we can resurrect that.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. I got one off the list one time, and I knew the warden, and he said, hey, I just got a fresh deer not very far from your house. Do you want it? He said, it looks like it was just hit in the head. Oh, okay, fine. I wasn't thinking clearly at the time, and he showed up and dumped the thing off the tailgate of his truck, and it sort of went splat on my driveway, and I said, that didn't sound good. And the problem is that the deer may look good, but the impact of a motor vehicle, I mean, I started to try and process that animal, and it was just kind of mush inside. Anyway, it turned out to be a serious error in judgment on my part, but maybe someone can call and tell us if that process is still in place or if that, like the pickup, is on a county-by-county discretionary basis. I don't know.
Yeah, a friend who doesn't hunt got a deer that had been hit by a car and asked me to cut it up for him, and I went to cut it up for him, and there was a good percentage of that deer that was not usable, for sure. Well, let's go to Mike in Lake Mills next. Hi, Mike.
Yes. Hi, Larry. A point and a question. The point is that my brother always says when you see a deer, don't look at the deer. Look at where it came from, because that's the next one's coming from.
That's a good idea.
And my question is, you know, we don't rake up our leaves. We leave them in the garden. We know that the critters and bees, et cetera, need them for nests. But I'm wondering, when do you recommend cleaning it out? Because eventually we have to clean the garden out in spring.
Well, I don't. Actually, I've been working diligently the last few days to try and use my leaf sucker-upper that I drag behind the lawn tractor to deposit all the leaves from the lawn in the garden. And I spread out a pretty good layer of them, and then my strategy is to just rototill those in to the garden come spring. So I solve my, they haven't fully decomposed, but they're certainly wet and break down.
On their way.
Break down pretty quickly, and then rototilling them in the garden adds a little organic material and loosens the soil a bit. So that's been my strategy, and it serves double duty of, I think, helping the soil in the garden and protecting what's left in there as mulch, essentially, and then also getting rid of the leaves. So the cleanup issue with the garden that we were going to talk about deals with not necessarily leaves coming off the trees, but plant material that's left in, whether it's a, you know, a couple stalks of Brussels sprouts that didn't get picked, or some old tomato plants, or asparagus, which has nice bushy tops, and leaving that stuff, if you can stand the look of it for the winter, you know, leave it alone, and then that provides maybe a little bit of shelter, but also a few remaining seeds or other materials that birds and small mammals might utilize. And then the cleanup after it's really dried out or decomposed is a little easier in the spring. So
that's
about the size of it.
Yeah, that's what I do. Mike, thanks. Appreciate it. Scott in Milford Hills. Hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Thanks, Scott. I just had a follow-up to the picking up roadkill deer. I believe the DNR now allows you to give them a call, and you can register that deer with them right over the phone and have permission to take that deer with you. If you either hit it yourself or come upon it, and the unfortunate party that hit the deer does not want it.
Correct.
Excellent.
Yeah, that I was aware of. How many people avail themselves of that, I'm not sure. Usually hitting a deer is such a traumatic thing that, you know, you've got an expensive repair facing you, or worse yet, the deer isn't dead, which is another whole issue that could be discussed. But that option, I think, is available. You can call the warden, or I think you can call the county sheriff, and they'll direct you to the warden, and then they can make the decision about picking it up, or again, somebody, a passerby who sees it hit or says, oh, that looks pretty fresh, can also lay claim to it.
Yeah. Thanks, Scott. Appreciate it. And around Milford Hills, there would be quite a few deer from time to time. Let's go to Rick in Madison. Hi, Rick.
Hi. Just a quick suggestion on the deer kill and eagle situation. There's a lot more eagles around lately, and thankfully. A lot of us are carrying a shovel or latex gloves, cheap box of latex gloves, a couple bucks in the back of the car to safely, if you can get out of your car, drag that deer off to the side. It's a real good protection for the eagles so they're not right on the roadside and get startled as you come around the corner. So that's an easy way to help protect the eagles.
Yeah.
That's an easy thing anybody can do to just help the general common good. But I just, as you pointed out, it's kind of the same thing as the advice we talk about in June when the turtles are out nesting. You know, oh, what do I do? There's a turtle trying to cross the road. Well, if you can safely stop and not endanger yourself, then fine. And it's the same thing with the deer carcasses. Mm-hmm. If you can pull over, it's a rural stretch of road or a quiet day or whatever, sure, great idea. And
absolutely.
Now that I think about it, I think I'll grab a box of latex gloves out of the garage where I keep them for processing and throw some in the car.
Yeah.
Good idea.
Good idea. Thank you, Rick. Appreciate it. And Jim in Camp Douglas, let's go to you next. Hi, Jim.
Hello there. Well, here's my version of the old outdoor life, this happened to me story.
Ah. Hey.
Hey, I worked at Fort McCoy some years ago, and I was on one of those car kill rosters where they awarded confiscated or roadkill deer to people that worked on the base if your name was drawn. My name was drawn about 2 o'clock one morning. The provost marshal called me and said, we got one for you. And I took it, and then I said, well, before you hang up, how was it killed? He told me, by a military deuce and a half. So I said, call the next guy on the list. But thanks anyway.
Well,
yeah.
That's my story.
Thanks, Jim.
I think the one that I claimed must have been hit by a big truck, too. But anyway, it's a good story.
Good story, Jim. Thanks a lot for calling. By the way, there were some open lines. We're going to get to Ken in Eau Claire County next, but there's a line for you at 1-800-642-1234. Do you have a wildlife question or maybe an experience to share? Give a call, 1-800-642-1234, or email your wildlife photo or question to our email at ideas@wpr.org. Ken, thank you for calling.
Hello?
Hi, Ken.
Hi, Larry. This is Ken Thompson calling. I think you might have already gotten your question answered. It was about picking up the deer. And I just wanted to let you know that anybody can pick up a deer, and all they have to do is call and report to the DNR that they picked it up.
Oh, okay. So you don't even have to call first and get permission, eh?
I would recommend calling first probably to get permission. They're going to ask you probably where it was killed and where you're taking it from, just in case a warden would find you with a deer that you should probably call ahead of time.
Yeah, that makes good sense. Ken, thank you. Yeah, but thanks very much. Ken's a warden, so.
Well, I mean, that makes sense. I'm pleased to hear that confirmed. But you know, given the fact that even with the hunting season on now, some parts of it, and the big gun season coming up a week from Saturday, you know, you can have a deer in your car. There are no tags anymore. The deer are not tagged. You just have to have the authorization or prove that you have the authorization for that particular harvest. So, same deal if a deer gets clobbered by the person in front of you and you're not optimistic about your hunting capability, then grab that deer on the side of the highway and you're good to go.
There we go. Thank you, Ken. Thanks again. Appreciate it. I have a story about another fellow who's does TV news here, did TV news in Madison, who actually hit a deer, kept it. It was the opening morning, so he was late getting out to his stand, and he got out there and sat a half hour, and then another deer came along, so he had two deer.
Well, remember a few years ago when we had the Ernabuck regulations, and if you turned in an antlerless deer, you got a buck sticker. And gee, the roads seem awfully clear that year. When I don't know how much of that was going on, but the rumor mill suggested that it was.
The rumor mill was going on pretty strong. Oh man! Well, Barbara in West Bend, on to you. Hi, Barbara.
Yes, thanks for taking my call, Larry.
Sure.
This is a mystery I'm trying to solve. I have an old farmhouse. It's my fourth winter, and rotating farm fields around me. There are corn, soybeans, and I think winter wheat being switched around. The first winter, we had corn in the neighborhood, and after it was harvested, I think we had about, close to, I made tally marks, 80 mice in the basement, caught them with live traps. And then the next two winters was soya and winter wheat. It wasn't so bad, maybe 10 total. Now we're starting on corn again. It was just harvested. And I have already, by now, since I started catching them a week and a half ago, 14. So is there a correlation that when corn is planted and then harvested, there are more mice trying to get into your house because maybe they take shelter in the cornfields and then they get cut down and they need new shelter?
Probably not, Barbara. The correlation is that, hey, it's harvest time of year, it's getting cold, and it's time for the mice, especially. I'm assuming the mice you were catching are the ones with the pretty little white bellies and feet, rather than house mice. But anyway, it's the time of year when those mice are going to seek shelter, regardless of what's happening with fall harvest. The fall harvest is proceeding because it's that time of year. The mice are coming into your house because it's that time of year. How many mice there are is more dependent on weather and where some of these animals are in their population cycle than what the neighboring farmer might be doing. A cornfield, the way corn is grown these days, doesn't provide a great deal of cover on the ground where the mice would be concerned about it. Some food maybe, yes, with spilled corn or corn that the deer are knocking down or whatever, but in terms of shelter or a cornfield be a good mouse habitat, not the case.
Yeah, right.
So I think the issue for anybody...
Tightening the house up.
Yeah, I mean, the issue for anybody this time of year is to be aware of the invasion of these white-footed or deer mice, a couple different species, because they're going to come in regardless of what's around you, because it's warmer and they have better shelter and can find food and so on. So everyone needs to do a little mouse-proofing right now, because it's supposed to get very cold over the next week or 10 days, and look for spots that are vulnerable to mouse invasion, where they've either chewed off the gasket at the base of a garage door, or there's a utility cable that enters and it doesn't have a guard on it, or loose siding, or whatever. And think like a mouse as you roam around the outside lower part of the house, and anything you find that could be a potential opening, stuff it with steel wool or whatever other material you have available that's pretty much mouse proof, and then at the same time be prepared to run the trap line like you're doing inside and thin them out that way.
Yeah, there we go. Barbara, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, let's go to John in Sturgeon Bay next. Hi, John.
Hey, good morning. Wanted to get your guest take on if he's heard any reports across the state or the area on the grouse population and what the hunters have been saying. We have a cabin up there in Clam Lake area, and we hunt pretty hard September, October, probably about a 20-square-mile area. And we have good reports. We keep a pretty detailed journal, and we put a lot of hours in with good dogs. And actually, we've been really surprised this year. I think we're averaging about a 1.7 flushes an hour. Pretty darn good. So just wondering what else you've heard.
Well, that is pretty good, John, and thank you for setting the stage for one of the things that was on our hit list to cover today.
Yeah.
There was a lot of anxiety going into the grouse season that, we had a lousy spring. The harvest was way down last fall when it should have been on the upswing because of the population cycle of grouse. The drumming counts were down again this spring. It was kind of a gloom and doom thing. And then they threw in the notion that, holy cow, maybe West Nile virus is involved, and there is testing taking place. But I haven't heard any reports on the West Nile testing yet. But the reports that I had around our cabin in Price County and from some other folks who have been out has generally been more reasonable, positive than yeah. negative, or at least reasonable. So people are having pretty good flush numbers. Everybody going out is seeing a few birds. Now, I have had other people say, oh, I walked my favorite trail for 3 miles and didn't get a flush or whatever. There's some of that. But there's some of that even in a decent year.
Yes.
But I guess I would, along with your report right now, say that certainly more than half, the majority of the reports that I've heard anecdotally are that, hey, we're pretty surprised and pleasantly surprised that we're seeing more birds than we thought we were going to. So that's
there you go.
Good news. How it will bear out at when all is said and done and the harvest statistics are in and the testing results are in, we'll have to wait and see. But so far, so good.
Glenn in New London has something for us. Hi, Glenn.
Yeah, hi. Listen, okay, I have a question about critters in general. I've had several problems of my critters getting into my truck and chewing through wires, chewing through hoses, and things like that. And this can get pretty expensive to fix.
Mm-hmm.
Any idea how to keep critters out from under your truck or out of your camper or boat or anything like that?
Yeah, the campers and the boats, they sit around all winter, and so they're in some ways almost easier to control.
I've had pretty good luck the last couple of years with my boat storage and a few other pieces of equipment in the outbuilding with a product called Mouse Magic, which is, it's not inexpensive. I think it comes in a 4-pack in a box. They're pouches. And it essentially, it smells like an air freshener, but I think it's based on balsam fir, which is very aromatic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the smell, which is kind of a minty menthol-like balsam smell, is said to repel mice. And so far, it's worked pretty well for me. I put a couple pouches I've got a couple of like filing cabinets or whatnot in the mm-hmm. garage and is part of my workbench, and I store all the manuals for my power tools and whatnot in there, and in the spring I come out and, oh my God, the manual for my chainsaw is now a pile of shredded paper made into a mouse nest. And that mouse magic has brought an end to that problem by putting a pouch in each of the drawers, and that takes care of it. By the same token, I always keep a couple of set traps, either in the boat, around the boat, on the boat trailer, or in other, or in the case of a stored vehicle, on the, you know, on the air filter or whatever, in an obvious spot, so that any mouse or other animal that beats whatever other defensive strategy you've come up with runs into the trap, and that's kind of the last line of defense. A lot of people do the same thing with naphthalene flakes, a type of moth flake. So naphthalene also has a strong aroma and is repellent to most mammals. The problem is that it volatilizes or evaporates pretty quickly. So every month or 6 weeks,
you need
to check it and either add some more flakes or the mothballs or whatever. That may work. And ammonia scent works the same way, although that also evaporates pretty quickly.
And so, what was the name of the product you used in the pouches?
I'm pretty sure it was Mouse Magic.
Mouse Magic.
I'm seeing the little pale blue box on my workbench right now, and I'm pretty sure that's the name of it. And I think there are a couple of products that work on the same principle.
All right. There you go, Glenn. Thanks for calling. Appreciate it. And let's go to JC in Wautoma. Hi, JC.
Hello. I have a question about a bird we have seen. We are in kind of a woodsy rural area outside of Wautoma. The bird was gold, really fluffy, a bit smaller than a robin. He had a bright orange beak and would eat bugs on the siding from our house. We have searched books and the internet and can't find out what it is.
Hmm.
Without a picture, any ideas?
An orange,
might have been an escape.
An orange beak, gold, and fluffy. Smaller than a robin. And now it was hanging on the side of the house like a woodpecker might, or it was just kind of fluttering?
No, it was on our porch railing, mm-hmm. and he would look at the house and then go get a bug and go back to the railing and eat it. You know, fairly large. I don't even know what kind of bugs they were. Maybe even wasps. So he was here for a couple days and gone.
That could be an escapee from a bird cage.
I don't know. The gold, I mean, gold, you say gold, you mean yellowish or metallic gold? Really gold.
Really gold, yep. Not yellow, not like a yellow finch or anything like that. But perhaps I could email a picture and...
Well, if you can email a picture, that would help.
That would help a lot.
Sure.
And at the same time, we'll use the strategy from Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, and we'll ask the audience. And if anybody has any great ideas on a gold bird, smaller than a robin, an insectivorous bird with an orange beak, give us a call.
Yeah, for sure. So stay listening, JC. Appreciate your call. Scott Craven, our guest today, wildlife ecologist. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. Talking about the world of wildlife today with our guest, Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining in. We'll go right back to the phones and take some more calls. Peg in Fitchburg, it's your turn. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Back in the middle of August, I was driving down a busy, somewhat rural highway, and I noticed a very large hawk or an eagle picking up a large limb out of the top of a dead tree along the side of the highway and flew off with it. You know, this limb was, I don't know, it's hard to tell, you know, 4 feet long, maybe more. What would it must have been a nest building material, but why would they be working on that at this time of year in August?
Well, might have had some damage to the nest.
Yeah,
I bet it's an eagle.
Really,
if it's
say, a... but picking up a big branch like that, you know, big stick nests are built by a number of large hawks from red tail size up, including ospreys, which would lug the limbs around, or
but a four-footer is...
Four-footer is a pretty big branch, depending on the diameter. So, but I guess regardless of the bird, the only reason for doing that would be repair or manufacture of a nest. It's not the time of year that typically that would be done, but on the other hand, some of the birds, like eagles, are incredibly faithful to those nest sites, and an eagle nest, there are records in the North Woods of eagle nests being nested in continuously, not by the same bird, but for decades. So they do keep them in pretty good repair. That's the only explanation I could come up with for
you. Yeah, there we go. Thanks, Bag. Appreciate it. And Cater in Herbster, your turn. Hi.
Hey, I just got a couple of things to add to what you've been talking about. One is, whenever I see a deer on the shoulder, I blow my horn, just short beeps. And I think at least my horn sounds enough like a distress call of a fawn or a doe that they always, all of them, turn and run into the woods instead of across the road. And the roadkill pickup number is right in the deer hunting handout or brochure, and my experience in using it is you don't have to contact a sheriff or a game warden. You just call that one number, and that's kind of a clearinghouse.
Okay.
And the last thing is, I'm an avid grouse hunter. I've been out almost every day this season up here near Lake Superior, and locally where I am, the numbers are drastically down from last year, where I might walk 2 or 3 hours and flush 10 or 15 birds. I see nothing. In some cover, in really good cover, there's still birds, but I have noticed that there's a lot fewer birds right around where I am.
Well, I appreciate that account. It takes a little of the steam out of John's count earlier that he was seeing good numbers. But what people need to realize is, as you pointed out, in good cover, there will always be a few birds. In lousy cover, there may not be anything even in a really good year. You hunt as much as you do, you know the difference between good cover and bad. You go to good cover and are not seeing birds, that's a little troubling. But in addition to the good cover or bad cover thing, there's also the local area kind of situation. Last year, we could hardly find a bird around my place in Price County, and then talking to another friend up there who hunted over near Hayward, he said, holy cow, we were getting all kinds of flushes. So there are a lot of variables involved, and I think we're really going to have to kind of wait until the end of the season, and everybody's experiences are in and assimilated, and the test results and the harvest data and everything else can be looked at critically and figure out what kind of a grouse season did we really have.
Thanks, Gator, for calling. You mentioned deer, and that reminds me, we've got the gun deer season coming up in a very short order, and there's already deer hunting, of course, going on with bow hunting and so forth.
Yes, there are a lot of folks out there taking advantage of the archery season. Of course, the advent of crossbow legalization a few years ago has added a lot of folks to the ranks there, and a lot of deer have been taken. Plus, back in early October, I think it was the weekend of the 6th and 7th, the youth hunt was on for 2 days, and I think there were close to 7,000 deer somewhere in that neighborhood taken by youth hunters, including one taken by my grandson, by the way, with me sitting right next to him. That was pretty cool. So the youth hunt is past us. The archery season is taking advantage of the rut right now. The granddaddy of them all, the Rose Bowl of the gun season of the deer hunting in Wisconsin, is the gun season, which opens a week from Saturday. There are a few regulations changes that, you know, we always advise hunters, you know, figure out where you are, what unit you're in, what tags you need to have, and then go from there. The regulation that was most troublesome to hunters was actually rescinded a few weeks ago, and that was the one that indicated that hunters who harvested a deer in a CWD-affected county could not move the deer out of that county without processing it. In other words, at least quartering it, the head spinal column had to be left at the site of the kill. And that was driving a lot of people to distraction, including me. But Anyway, legislative committee took a look at that in conjunction with another regulation that dealt with deer fencing on game farms. They kept the deer fencing regulation, but they threw out the regulation about processing the deer before you could take them home. So that made a lot of hunters breathe a sigh of relief, and probably in the long run, given the fact that we've been dealing with CWD for 16 years now, if that regulation might have been effective, it was too little too late. But anyway, it's over and done with. CWD testing this year on that subject will be done at kiosks that are strategically located around the state. I checked out the nearest one to me the other day, and they're all set up with plastic bags and little pouches with the ID tags and clear instructions and photos to guide how to take the head off and so forth. Take the head off your animal, put it in the bag, get the tag, you get one, one goes in the bag, kind of like a raffle ticket. Essentially, it is sort of like a raffle.
Yeah. But
anyway, you put it in the kiosk, and then they're picked up, taken to the facility for testing, and you can check online, or I think you'll eventually get the card that they've been doing in the past, too. But you can follow that tracking number online to see how your deer tested. I do recommend that you, and if you're in a heavily affected area,
should test.
I think you should have them tested. The outlook for the season in general looks great. There are lots of deer around, at least the ones that haven't been run over on the highway that we discussed earlier. So the outlook looks pretty good statewide. Maybe we can talk later if we go low on callers about what to do with all that venison. The only other thing I wanted to point out was the new Hunt Wild Wisconsin app that the DNR has put together for use on your smartphone. I downloaded a few weeks ago, and I've been using it for pheasant hunting, and I will use it for deer hunting. But if for no other reason than as you identify the type of hunting you're doing, it immediately shows you on the bottom of the screen what the legal shooting hours are for that day, and it kind of counts you down to the end of shooting hours.
Which is very cool.
Which is very cool. And because I used to look at that chart with about 19 columns and 20 lines, and
yeah.
I said, where are my glasses? I can't read this. And then you had to subtract 10 minutes or add 3 minutes or whatever. This is all done for you now. In addition to, it immediately comes up with a screen with a Google Earth image and a little blue dot as to where you are. So I've been just looking at that while I'm pheasant hunting. Holy cow, if you zoom in, there's the tree I'm standing next to from a satellite. I'm easily impressed by technology like that. But that Hunt Wild app will allow you to do all sorts of stuff.
How do you get it?
You can just go on the DNR website. They're advertising it regularly. It's free. And there's, I think, the app for the tutorial is huntwild@wisconsin.gov, but you can get to it off the search image on the DNR website. And you can register your animals on it. You can read a summary of the regulation. You can track with the GPS, you know, the routes you're following. It's pretty neat. So that's a nice innovation, and folks will have fun with it. If it's cold and boring, you can watch yourself moving around in the woods. So, you know, again, I wish that with the deer season coming up, there'll be a lot of folks out there. Good luck to everybody. Above all else, be safe. Do not fire that firearm unless you know exactly what you're shooting at and what's beyond it and all the basic rules of safe gun handling. And a lot of people will be taking home some venison. So
there we go. Well, back to that gold bird for just a minute. Kate and Tom both contacted us separately to suggest that the bird the caller is seeing is probably an evening grosbeak.
An evening grosbeak is so distinctively black, yellow, and white. And it has a big conical bill because they're seed eaters,
yeah.
not bug eaters. So I good try, appreciate the help, but boy, I'd be mighty surprised if it was an evening grosbeak.
We got to get a photo of that
yes.
bird. Then we can. JD in Sparta, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hello there.
Hi, what's on your mind?
Well, I'm a contractor that deals with the deer on the interstate and the state highways.
Okay.
And if you have any questions, I can answer them.
Well, what what's the current procedure? Let's say you're heading up Highway 39 going from Madison to Wausau, and there's a dead deer on the highway, and it seems like, you know, it's at the point where the skin's pulling away from the carcass and so forth. What happened in that particular county? Did it not get reported, or what happened?
There's a lot of deer that do not get reported, and if you find a deer, I guess I would put a little word of warning. If you steal the antlers, it's nice for them for racking and stuff, but if you steal the antlers, it is, I believe, illegal.
Yes.
And you need to call and ask for permission to take the deer, and there's been talk about that previously, and that's all correct.
Right. Okay.
I will just make a comment that the gentleman that hit 20 deer and a bear and so forth, I wouldn't be real proud of that record. I've gone 1 million miles doing this for 10 years, and I've had a deer yet to hit me hit a deer, but I've had two deer hit me.
Yeah.
Okay.
There you go. Well,
thank you.
Yeah, thanks, JD. Appreciate that call. Well, Scott Craven, our guest today, and of course, you know, he's been doing this. How many years you been doing this now? You and I.
It was early July last year, I think, that I started. Oh, it must be 30 years
now.
Yeah,
we've been doing it for a long, long time, and it's always fun. And he's not leaving us now. He's going to wait till at least 12:30. So he'll be here to answer your questions and comments and listen to your stories, and probably listen to my stories as well. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. He's an emeritus professor, and always great to have him with us. You can join in, 800-642-1234. Email at ideas@wpr.org. Back with Scott right after this look at the news. Stay with us. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network as we take a look at the world of wildlife with Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist. I'm Larry Mueller. And I know we're going to be talking about some gift ideas for the wildlife enthusiast on your list, so we can answer that. We'll talk about some other things as well with him as we visit with Scott. So first, let's talk to a couple of people who've been waiting a while on the phone. Carol in Boscobel, it's your turn. Thanks for waiting.
Thanks for having me on.
What can we do for you?
Well, I've got a problem with a skunk.
Uh-oh.
And I don't know how to solve it. It's decided to take up residency in my hay shed underneath one of my bins that I keep my cat food in. So I think it's dug a burrow. I'm not sure. And I am afraid to move the bin out that the skunk's going to be there. So I'm not sure how to go about getting rid of this little rascal. It's eating up my cat food.
Okay. Well, one thing you could do is move the cat food.
Yeah, can you move the cat food? I mean, one of the ways to deal with animal problems is to determine what's attracting them, and in this case, I think we know. What about the cat food?
Well, I could put it down in the other shed, but I'm not sure if my cats would find it, and then they'd probably take up residence there. And I try to feed them so that there isn't any food left at night.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that's why I think it's created a burrow under there, because there's easy water access. They're one of my automatic waters, and there's the food, and, you know, I've gotten rid of a lot of possum and a few coon throughout the year. But this first time we've had a skunk decide to take up residence.
Yeah.
Well, let's think about the possibilities. Are you viewing this as a do-it-yourself proposition? Or, I mean, there are certainly wildlife control contractors around the state who
near Boscobel, there's one.
Remove problem animals for a fee. That's one option. If you don't want to consider that, then and they're often in the yellow pages for a given area, more common around larger urban areas than in rural parts of the state. But I'm sure you could find somebody. Similarly, quite a few members of the Wisconsin Trappers Association often do this kind of thing as a service or for some payment, and there are trappers widely distributed around. The Trappers Association used to publish a little guidebook of individuals who would do that along with their contact information. So you could probably find out about willing trappers from either your local DNR office or see what you can find online with the Wisconsin Trappers Association. So that's one possibility where you could get help. On your own, I would have suggested a simple wire live trap like you'd use for rabbits or coons or whatever, but the bait for that, like a can of sardines or a can of cat food,
I can
tell you what you're going to catch before you catch the skunk, and so that's going to make that trapping issue rather problematic. And of course, many people are then troubled even if they catch the skunk. Okay, now I got a skunk in a wire trap. What the heck am I going to do? Well, there are ways to deal with that if you decide to go that route. They're a reasonably docile animal if you handle them carefully and quietly, but those options aside, and the reason you go with somebody else is that they will know how to handle it in the trap. It becomes their problem rather than yours. The other issue is something under there that the skunk will find more offensive than the attraction of the cat food. And that could include the kinds of things we were talking about with mice a little while ago.
They hate mothballs.
They hate naphthalene or mothballs. I don't know what the cats will do with that, but that's... dealing with the cats is another long story, but you obviously value the cats and not the skunk, so we'll focus on the skunk. The naphthalene might be worth a try, and that may cause it just to relocate. If you get it outside, it may be easier to trap. And of course, if you happen to see the skunk out foraging around on we're not going to have a warm evening anytime soon, but if it does warm up, of course, if you have access to a firearm, a shotgun, the skunk could be shot.
Yeah.
If it's out where you see it. So I'd be tempted to try the naphthalene or an ammonia-soaked rag or something like that under there where you think the skunk is. Push it under with a stick or something if you have to and see if that does any good.
Yeah.
And then, as Larry said at the outset, move the cat food.
Yeah, get rid of it.
Put it somewhere where the skunk is not going to take up residence. And if you have to, lug a bowl out for a while, so be it. At least that may solve the skunk problem. Then you can go back to business as usual.
There you go, Carol.
Good luck.
Thanks for calling. Bob in Crivitz, your turn. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Larry. How are you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call.
Okay, I got two things, so don't cut me off here. Okay, one is with a young lady who was just talking about the skunk. Okay, and I got a cabin up here west of Crivitz. Okay, he had two of them under his deck, and he couldn't get rid of them. And another fellow told him, put a radio under there and put it on loud. Okay, and they were gone within a day. Okay, they can't stand the loud noise. Okay, and the other thing was getting rid of rodents or mice. Bounce fabric softener will take care of both of them.
In a vehicle, you're saying?
In a vehicle as well as in, I got an 18-foot muskie boat, okay, a bass boat. But I've got, a lot of money stuck in rods and reels. They were always chewing them up. Okay, and I put a bounce tissue in my rod boxes, two of them, and two of them in my my bait boxes, and just like that. And I did the same thing with my custom band that I traveled through Canada with. Okay, I never had a mouse in there again.
Wow.
Well, it's worth a try. I'm going to, along with using the latex gloves in the truck, I'm going to swipe my wife's box of bounce fabric softener out of the and spread that all over the barn tonight. So two things to do on my to-do list. I think that the radio idea has some merit. If he could get tapes of the Larry Miller show.
talking?
Yeah, I think that would probably do it.
Oh, probably some rock and roll loud noise music might work better. Well, thanks, Bob. Appreciate it. We have a couple things that I wanted to bring up before we run out of time, and there's still plenty of time for calls, but holiday gifts ideas. There's so many good ones out there for people who like the outdoors and like wildlife. They don't have to necessarily be hunters or anything else to enjoy.
No, you can meander through any number of places that have a good outdoor section, ranging from one extreme, the Bass Pro Cabela's stores. If you can't find an idea in there, then you're not paying careful attention. But on the other end of the spectrum, the bird feeder, art fanciers, places like Wild Birds Unlimited stores, the outdoor section, and everything from Farm and Fleet to the local hardware store. There's going to be a ton of stuff in terms of gear and equipment, ranging from knives to good boots to all sorts of technology to fine optics, bird feeders, just
I think the cameras,
the trail cameras are a great idea.
And it doesn't matter if you live in the city; you'd be amazed at some of the things you might find.
Yeah, some things you don't want to see
wandering across in your backyard.
The other end of things, I've always thought that for folks who, as the gift recipient, who are interested in a particular species or maybe an opportunity to get involved with like-minded people, consider a gift membership in any number of the non-governmental organizations like Ducks Unlimited, Trout Unlimited, Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, Ruff Grouse Society, Pheasants Forever, Whitetails Unlimited, and I know I've missed some, but Wild Turkey Federation. There are dozens of them, and they do a lot of good work. The money goes to help their activities and support conservation, and it gets the recipient there. Usually they have a magazine or newsletter. They go to get an invitation to the banquets. That's kind of a cool thing to do. There are all sorts of subscriptions. I keep up to date on a lot of things that are going on with my subscription to Outdoor News.
Yeah.
Here in Wisconsin, it comes
Wisconsin
by weekly.
Outdoor News is great.
It's a great source of information and what's going on, the same kinds of questions that we deal with on the program. Multitudes of books. There's all kinds of wildlife-related art in different media. It's fertile ground for gift giving ideas if you've been stymied at other areas.
One of the other things I wanted to talk about just briefly was at least the elk hunt. The elk hunt was not the well. It was successful for some, but not for others.
Well, I think it's still on. I'm not sure about the exact dates, but I checked last night to try and get an update of where we stood to refresh people's minds. Elk were restored to Wisconsin beginning way back in 1995. There are a couple of populations now, but the feeling had always been when the elk reached a threshold population, there would be a limited hunting opportunity. And that decision was made for this year after all these years, almost 25 years. And it was decided that 10 harvest tags would be allocated. 5 were to go to Wisconsin tribes who are cooperators in the management and restoration of elk, and 5 would go to other hunters. 4 reserved for essentially a lottery or draw system that the DNR administered, and 1 was set aside for another important cooperator in the whole process, the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation. And that was raffled off at their banquets and awarded to another Wisconsin citizen. Well, anyway, as of last night, the 5 tribal tags had all been filled. None of the 4 tags allocated by the lottery draw had been filled, but I guess there's still some opportunity. The one the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation had raffled off and awarded, an elk was harvested very early in the season, but there's some legal complications of how it was taken or whatever. I don't know how that's been resolved. There was a big article about it in Outdoor News a couple weeks ago. So anyway, however it happened, the tribal hunters seem to have done very well, and I don't know what's going on with the others, so that's the update.
There you go. And, we've talked about taxidermy on the show in the past.
Yeah, we did.
And you've been the recipient of several emails relating to that.
I could never have imagined when I first mentioned this. I think it's got to be 3 years ago on the program, and we came up with the idea that I had known from experience and incidental contact that there are lots of people around with taxidermy in the basement or garage or attic or whatever.
A deer head or a
deer
pheasant.
Head, ranging from a single deer head to apparently huge collections. And at the same time, I was hearing from nature centers and schools and other educational facilities, boy, we could sure use some mounts to, you know, decorate our new exhibit hall or whatever. I thought, well, gee, maybe we can put willing donors together with willing recipients and do a little bit of a service. So we mentioned that on the program quite a while ago. And
that has evolved nationally.
Oh, God, it's gone. It's gone crazy. So it's at the point now where here, even almost 3 years later, hardly a week goes by that I don't get an email from somewhere, I often don't know where, offering up something. Can you help me find a place for this? And just in the last, now, when you walked up to me in the lobby here today, just before the program, I had just opened an email and I showed you the pictures on my phone. I said, look at all these mounts. I'll have to find out where the person is from and how we might help them place them. But the point is, we were right. There's an incredible amount of this stuff out there. And it's often a case where the hunter who harvested it at all or created the collection has passed on, and the family says, what the heck are we going to do with this stuff? On up from the single deer head that you describe, last week it was a black rhinoceros head on the East Coast that the guy wanted some help with. It's been unbelievable, including last month a collection outside Detroit of over 350 mounts, appraised by the insurance company at over $500,000, and that collection we've actually been able to place. So I'm still trying to keep up with this, but I would just say apparently what happened after the program is that this got up on the internet somehow and has now exists in cyberspace.
Well, you can hear us anywhere in the country.
Yeah.
So,
you know, people are still...
Anywhere in the world, really.
Are still... It seems to be snowballing. And I'm still willing to try and do some brokering, so if people make contact with me, my intention was to work locally where I have contacts with nature centers and so forth, and we did place some things. I was running around collecting. I collected a lake trout from one person, and it ended up in Door County at an exhibit, and we placed this and that here and there, but this has gotten bigger than me. But if people are still, you know, have collections they're trying to find a home for, I can at least offer some general tips on the kinds of places or people you would contact locally. And I work now with a couple of brokers nationally who are willing to help with bigger collections. So
there you go.
I don't know where it's going from here, but we'll see.
So if we type your name in, Scott Craven, into the search engine, what's your email address?
Yes.
How do we get a hold?
For the taxidermy stuff, it's just srcraven@wisc.edu.
srcraven@wisc.edu. There you go.
We'll see what happens.
What are you going to do with that rhino head?
I don't know. I've got to get back to that guy. It's the difficulty in this is that shipping the stuff can be a huge
expense
and hassle. And, you know, a rhino head, well, I don't know. The market is... People have not... My experience is that while the good taxidermy is very good, it looks like the animal, it's a wonderful thing to look at, it's a piece of art. Bad taxidermy, not so much, or something that hasn't been cared for 70 years. Most of the stuff that people are coming to me with has been very good, but it meant a lot to the person who perhaps shot the animal in Namibia or something, but you know, to somebody else, well, gee, I wasn't in Namibia to harvest this animal. It's meaningless to me. So, I don't know. We're it's a work in progress, but it has amazed me how many people have come forward with stuff.
Well, we have Nick in Whitewater with a question for you.
Okay, hi guys, how's it going?
Good, appreciate the call. What's in your mind?
Okay, so like early this summer, I was heading up from Madison to Whitewater,
along the interstate, and there were three gigantic birds that I have never seen in the state before. I spent a fair amount of time in the outdoors. I've seen quite, you know, most of what's out there. But these were, they're bigger than a turkey by quite a bit. They kind of like a stork look about them, kind of a big, long bill, you know, real tall bird. They're kind of tan and brown, kind of mottled. And they're just huge, huge birds. And I was just wondering if you guys might have some insight as to what those might be.
I don't think there's much mystery to this one. Those are sandhill cranes.
Yeah, they almost have to be.
They almost have to be. They're grayish. The young ones have a mottled rusty brown appearance to them. And if you see three of them along the road, it's often an adult pair with a colt or with a young one. I'd be pretty sure in this case that's what you saw. We're limited in our gigantic birds, and sandhills of that color and that setting are certainly ones that would fill the bill.
Yep, there you go. Doug in Indianapolis emailed to ask if a white salt block or mineral block can be used for drawing deer. Oh, he wonders if a white salt block or a mineral block is best for drawing deer. Is that even legal in?
Well, I think that's under the same restrictions as feeding and baiting in the CWD affected or adjoining counties. So I think a mineral lick would still be legal in. I'm trying to think of how many we're up to. You know, darn near 2/3 of our counties are affected by these bans to control CWD. So their use in Wisconsin is limited legally.
Doug's in Indianapolis. In Indiana, we don't know. But let's say it was legal. Would you use a white salt block or a mineral block?
Well, I wouldn't use either one because I subscribe
either
to the notion that, you know, baiting and attracting is for me, it affects the issues of fair chase. So I wouldn't use one. I see both used with some regularity, and even, you know, out at the farm in Iowa County, I remember we had to drain the water softener one afternoon when we were out for the deer season, and we came back a couple weeks later, and the deer had excavated a huge pit where we dumped out the water softener. So I think any salty mineral like content would probably be attractive if it's legal and if you want to do it.
Well, Russ and Stoughton, do you have a quick question?
It just came up as you were talking. My brother-in-law was just busted by the DNR in Vilas County in Boulder Junction for putting out a salt block because of the CWD, and they're not allowed to feed them. He's very upset about that. And also, I wanted to mention that as far as the turtles crossing a road, number one, you have to make sure that you're aware that their first line of defense when you pick them up is to try and pee on whatever is approaching them. And the other thing is you don't want to steer them away from the direction they're going.
Yeah, right.
Absolutely.
Both good points. And on that note, we, Scott, are out of time. Man, it's been fun.
It went quickly, and it was fun.
You're going to be back next year on January 2nd. We'll do this all.
In the meantime, hey, everybody have a great deer season and happy holidays.
Scott Craven, our guest, emeritus wildlife ecologist with UW Extension. Great to have him along. He'll be back in 2019. Oh, my gosh, first time I've said that. January 2nd of 2019. Tomorrow, we'll look at home improvement things with Chad Spate. We'll talk about the cost of renovation, among other things. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.